Well, it finally happened. I lost an episode project.
Oh, no.
Episode 134, last week's episode.
What'd you do?
Lost to history.
Oh, no.
Lost to time.
How'd you lose it?
There's an E-134 shaped hole in my heart now. Nothing will ever fill it.
Brad, are we going to have to re-record the episode?
My 133 episode long streak of backing up every project for this podcast has been broken.
Do you have a Shadow Volume copy?
I don't. So it was on my system drive. It was on my C drive. First of all, let me back up a little bit.
Did you lose a C drive?
No. I feel like saying that I lost the project maybe is unfair because that implies that it happened to me.
Do you not save?
As opposed to the reality that I actually just forgot to archive it before I deleted it.
Was it not in your recycle bin?
No.
Do you not use your recycle bin, Brad?
Not very much. So is this a common thing? I have developed the muscle memory of just shift deleting everything in Windows.
Well, that'll do it.
Which is kind of bad.
The whole point, look, there's a whole system. There's layers of,
I know.
Okay, you have a NAS.
Well, that's where the backups go. I mean, I 7-zip the project every week and put it on my NAS. But
you can also turn on Shadow Volume copies on your C drive, and then it'll just save it won't overwrite the stuff until you need the space, even when you hard delete stuff.
I thought that's how it worked by default.
Yeah, it's probably still there.
Okay, maybe this is what I want to talk about. I have tried, so the Discord recommended something called Recuva.
Yeah.
R-E-C-U-V-A. I tried that.
That's a terrible name.
It's not great, but apparently it's like endorsed by people who know. There's also something called Windows File Recovery now that Microsoft makes. Check this out. It's a command line utility that, as far as I can tell, they only distribute on the Windows Store.
There's a lot of that.
But it is only a command line utility, really? Is that not uncommon?
I downloaded some POSIX stuff from the Windows Store the other day.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So like the command is WinFR. That's the executable?
Yep.
But again, it's command line only. Like, you download it from the Windows Store, and then you know how after you download something, it changes from download to open? And you click the open button after it downloads, and it just pops a terminal window and runs it with no arguments. It's ridiculous. Huh. It's a ridiculous way to distribute software.
That's pretty stupid. Yeah, you could have used WinGet to get it too, probably.
You've talked too much yang about WinGet that I just tend to avoid it.
It seems like it's improving.
Is it getting better?
I typed in something that was super common and I didn't get a bunch of spam the other day. So that was pretty exciting.
Let me just search right now and see if WinFR is on there. It is not. When I search WinGet, search WinFR, the only thing I came up with is something called the Oprah Winfrey Network.
I mean, that sounds good too. You get a car and you get a car and you get a car.
You get a recovered file. You get a recovered file. I ran WinFR. It has like three different methods of searching for lost or deleted files, and nothing came back. I think that project is just gone.
I will remember you. I don't know what to say about this. I am shocked. I was going to say you have one job, but actually you have like many of us, you have many jobs, but like, this is shocking to me, Brad. I thought you had a bulletproof system.
My bulletproof system was just to make sure I backed that thing up before I deleted it.
One errant press of the shift key.
Yep.
And I was going to say, I'm going to tell you something scary that you're not going to like at all.
Okay.
I don't ever delete the projects from my C drive. I have all of them on there still.
Projects for what?
The Audacity projects, or the Audition projects, and the Audacity projects, frankly. Oh,
well,
I got it all.
Those are pre-edits, so
those are
of limited utility. How big is your C drive?
2 terabytes, maybe? I don't know.
Mine is 512 gigabytes. It's space is a bit more of a premium for me.
Well, I mean, you gotta, it's look. Get another reason. It's time. You should turn on file history.
Yeah.
Given the space you have on your NAS for storing stuff long term, it's like one of the reasons I got the big C drive was so I could turn on file history and have the Shadow Volume copies of all my old stuff. Basically,
does that work in Windows 10?
It works in Windows 10 as well.
I might turn that on right now. Actually, yeah, you know, anything on the NAS is super backed up, but the file has to make its way to the NAS before that.
Well, it's almost like there's a flaw in your otherwise bulletproof system.
Let's start the show. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
Hi, I'm Brad.
What's up?
How do you keep doing that? They didn't hear any of the pre-recording banter. They don't know what that means.
We're talking about 1993, man.
Oh, was that actually 93?
No, it was 99. I looked it up. Oh. I was kind of sad. I thought it was 93.
Okay.
And then I thought, Bud Wiser. But that was 95, so that was disappointing.
That one was okay.
Yeah. The 93 was when I think the Real Men of Genius ads started, if you want to go for your great years in bad beer advertising.
I'm looking here. It looks like Bud Bowl 5 was the big Super Bowl 1993.
Yep.
Let's see. There was the Jordan versus Bird McDonald's ad.
Oh, that was pretty good. That was a good ad.
There was the Crystal Pepsi launch ad.
Oh, you mean the jump. No, it was clear.
Was it right now?
Was he right here right now?
Right now.
Yeah.
Van Halen right now. Yeah. Van Hagar, excuse me.
Yeah, not real Van Halen, man.
Why are we talking about 1993?
Well, today's my birthday.
Wait, is it actually today?
Well, today for them, not today for us.
Happy birthday.
It's tomorrow for you.
Happy preemptive birthday.
Thank you. And as has become our new tradition on our birthdays, we open the history books.
Yeah.
And we go back to a formative year for us in technology.
Yes. Yeah, last year on our birthdays, we each did our birth year.
Yep.
1997
and 1979, respectively. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I enjoy these enough that I would say we should do them more than twice a year. But
I'm into that. I mean, we might run out of years if we do more than one a year, though.
That is true.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, we have waited for your birthday again. You chose 1993, I believe, because it's the year you graduated from high school.
You know, it's
is that correct?
The year that I graduated from high school is like a normal formative year for most people, I think. For me, it's the year that I got on the internet.
Okay.
Because I went to college. I was part of the Eternal September, which we'll talk about.
I see.
I went to college and they were like, hey, here's a vax thing. And then I went and I didn't buy my meal plan and was like, I'm just going to eat garbage for the first half of the year. And I used that money to buy a modem and a sound card.
Good choice.
Yeah. And then I got on the vax and I was like, this is cool. I can Archie and Gopher from anywhere and get information from anywhere in the world. It's like a list of FTP sites.
I'm meeting people from all around the world. This is great and positive and will never be misused by anyone.
Yeah. Well, like literally there were some exchange. I had neighbors who were exchange students from Malaysia and they were using IRC to talk to like family members at home. And I was like, this is incredible. And then I discovered Usenet and like went down. Anyway, it was a good year for me. 93 was a good year.
Yes. A fine vintage.
Yeah. Maybe the last of the good ones.
That's a bold claim. That'll take some extra consideration. But anyway, yeah. We're basically just here to recap some of the.
It's a walk down memory lane.
Yeah. The big items, the historical factoids.
No bummers, though.
In tech and science of 1993.
We had a hard rule this year because look, 1975, pretty good year all around. There was, you know, a little badness here and there. You had Three Mile Island in 79, which is, you know, as nuclear accidents go, pretty good.
Yeah. Could have been worse.
1993, a lot of bummers. So we're just skipping those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny how that just keeps getting worse. Anyway, what do we got here?
You want to just start at the top of the list and go down?
These are not in any specific order.
They're kind of order of impact, kind of.
Yeah.
But there's some special stuff separated out into its own little segments. So yeah,
I did mean to move the file formats from the end because I don't know that ending on.
Yeah, but you move. Look, there's still time. The document will update itself.
Okay. Let's get started.
But I think in terms of the things that had the largest impact of the year, it's hard to overstate the importance of the dawn of the EU.
Yeah.
So in 93, in November, on November 1, the European Common Single Market was formed, which was the birth of the euro. And it basically meant goods, services, money, and people could move freely amongst the signatory states, which was a new thing. There were a handful of countries that didn't sign on for the euro right away, and the UK famously never did before they bailed out a couple years ago. But for the most part, this is all of Europe, formerly frequently warring antagonistic Europe, bundling up together into a happy collective of superpower sized collective. It's a big deal.
Yes. Was the euro there at the start?
The euro was there at the start. Okay. But like, I think France and Germany and the UK, the people with strong currencies, and Norway, maybe Switzerland, I can't remember, signed on late. So, so like they came in over subsequent years for probably reasons involved. But the big deal was, like, from a like, hey, we want to make stuff in these areas. It meant that if something was manufactured in Sweden, somebody in Italy could buy it without having to worry about tariffs and border crossings and stuff like that. You could just ship stuff, like, for all intents and purposes, all the border crossings in Europe opened up at that point.
Yeah. You could ship yourself for that matter, right?
Not just you goods. Could just walk if you wanted.
Yeah, right. Like, you could just travel. So I just Googled the name, the Schengen area. Are you familiar with that?
No.
So I think that was established in 1985. I mean, I'm literally researching this on the fly, so I don't have a lot to add here other than, like, that's the name I see today applied to the area, the region of, what is it, to 26 countries?
Yeah, it was 27 until a few years ago. Weird.
Officially abolished all passport and other types of border control at their mutual borders. I don't know if that is maybe like a superset of the original
EU
zone. I'm not sure.
So, look, this all happened after I took Western Civilization last time. So, you know, the details are sometimes fuzzy. My understanding is that this whole thing started, this is a process that was going on for a long period of time. And the Maastricht Treaty, which is what happened on November 1, 1993, was the kind of like the moment. Like, unlike, say, the formation of the United States, where it was a bunch of old white guys who got together and signed the Declaration of Independence and told King George to go fuck himself, this was more of a gradual process over a period of time. Yeah. So, like, there's stair steps all along the way, is my understanding. The Europeans are screaming at their radios right now, and I apologize.
Well, let me add some context real quick here then. Yeah, so the Schengen area apparently specifically applies to people travel.
Ah.
And then the free movement of goods and services is the European single market. So,
this was the second to last stair step then, I guess.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, a big deal for future,
not really us,
trade and commerce and you know, technological development and all that stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It was just like, sometimes we do big news stuff in here. Should we talk about 3D graphics? You want to talk about the birth of the interwebs? Those are both pretty big. I think one is bigger than the other.
Yeah, I mean, inarguably, I think the birth of the web is how I have described this, the set of goings on in 93. So the final 1.0 version of NCSA Mosaic came out in April. I guess at least some kind of beta version was out in like January of that year, though.
That's the National Center for Supercomputing Applications.
Yeah. So that's at UIUC, right? University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, right?
Yeah, I think they call it Urbana-Champaign, but I don't know.
Is that how you...
I know a couple of people who work there, I think.
It's weird. I think we've talked about this before, like being on the relatively early internet, there was a small set of universities that you saw the addresses of constantly, and that was one of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like the people who had big FTP sites, it turns out, had an oversized influence early on.
What else was there? There was like MIT. There was SUNY, MIT, RIT.
There was one in Texas. Was it Texas Tech?
Maybe.
I feel like hoptoad.texastech was one of the Texas TC.
I can't remember. Anyway, you know, there was a handful of universities around the country that were just super big in early internet development. And that was UIUC.edu, I think, is one that I saw constantly. I didn't realize there was government money behind the first version of Mosaic.
Didn't you know that Al Gore invented the internet, Brad?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I've heard the memes and the stereotypes and the jokes constantly, but I didn't realize that the Gore bill is actually what provided the funding for the development of NCSA Mosaic.
Indeed. And a bunch of other stuff.
Sure. National Center for Supercomputing Applications is like a weirdly trying to think how to describe it. It's not quite militaristic, but there's almost like a shadowy government agency sound to it.
Well, they do fluid and weather modeling stuff there. So they measure, because like fluid modeling is really complicated because every single bit can impact every other bit. So you have to, like, you can't, it's not like a sequential problem. You have to do it all. Anyway,
it's chaotic.
It's interesting. But so Tim Berners-Lee is the one I generally think of in terms of, hey, here's the World Wide Web starting. Oh, for
sure. Absolutely. I, real quick, though, before we move on from Mosaic, I didn't realize there was such a direct through line from that browser, which was developed with government money, straight through to Netscape.
Oh, yeah. Because it wasn't Mosaic open?
I think so. I don't have it in front of me. I don't know, like, what the state also that was like so early in the kind of concept of open source. I don't know what that would have looked like. I believe it was just kind of freely accessible. But Mark Andreessen was the leader of the team that developed the first Mosaic, and then he left with some other people and started a company that I think actually was originally called Mosaic Communications before they rebranded to Netscape.
I believe that that is correct. Yeah. Mosaic, Netscape had a, this is based on code from NCSA Mosaic tag for as long as I remember.
Huh. I did not realize that. But anyway, yes, you're right. Tim Berners-Lee was like the actual guy. That same year in April, 1993.
Yes.
At CERN.
It's a French acronym, so I don't remember this one.
CERN is so cool.
Norm, when I was attested and the year my daughter was born, Norm got to go to CERN while I was off on paternity leave.
Oh, man.
And he went to the Large Hadron Collider and did all the stuff there. And I was like, this is literally the most jealous I've ever been of a coworker.
Totally.
Like, for like work related stuff.
Like that's why CERN, I mean, there are a lot of reasons I think it's cool, but among them are that they both invented the web and also have a bunch of particle accelerators there. And it, like, even the name being French makes it somewhat more exotic to me. Anyway, Tim Berners-Lee developed like all of it, like HTTP, the protocol, HTML, the markup language for web pages, the client and server and all that stuff.
Do you put the Bling tag in? Was that him?
Oh, I don't know. Does that make him history's greatest monster?
Look, I think the Blink tag had a place.
It did at one time. So like I found a bunch of different references to like the language, I think from Wikipedia, or this might have been from CERN's own site, was, quote, put the World Wide Web software in the public domain. I'm not quite sure what that means in terms of like opening code or whatever, but it was like free to use from the get-go.
Well, so that we talked about this on the licensing episode. It just means that there's no terms attached to it. So okay. Like there's no ownership. There's no
nothing. There's no
license. It's just there. It's for everyone to use for all mankind.
Yes. So
all humankind.
Yes.
It was all built on a Nextbox.
Yes. Which I think I was
shocked by.
Yes. I don't know where that thing has ended up, but like the Next workstation that he developed all that stuff on is like a piece of history.
I thought it was
got auctioned or something.
It belongs in a museum, Brad.
It probably does.
Yeah.
Wasn't he like dabbling with NFTs for a while recently?
I mean, he worked at Google for a long time. I don't know what he did after that. The interesting thing about the browser, like the interesting thing about this is this is the thing that comes up in the metaverse talk a lot, is everybody's like, oh, the metaverse is an application, but it's really not. Like this, the reason the web took over was it was a protocol that delivered these HTML files via a server, and those, the client, the server, the protocols and the HTML spec all work together to make this thing like extensible and functional in a way that wasn't, that we hadn't really seen before from web protocols. Cause previously, like IRC is a good example. Cause no matter what IRC client you used, the input and output were the same. It was just a scrolling chat window, right? Yeah. Usenet was kind of similar. People extended and stuff like that. So you could do things like share files and binary files and stuff like that. But fundamentally, you were looking at these posts that were encoded in ASCII and, you know, transmitted as ASCII files across modem, you know, internet connections. I don't know. It was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Who knew?
It was a big deal. I found a picture here of that first Nextbox, which, according to the attribution, looks like it may reside at the Science Museum in London now.
Maybe? Oh, that's a good place for it.
Also, there's a big sticker still on it to this day, written in like pink Sharpie. This machine is a server. Do not power down! !!
like you think the cleaning crew is going to come in and literally turn off the web?
No, that sticky note is a piece of history. Come on.
No. I'm saying the sticky note's there? Because like the person who comes in and empties the trash cans at night is like, oh, this computer's still on. I'm going to turn off. Boom.
Right. Yes.
The web goes dark.
I guess at one time that physical machine was the entire World Wide Web.
Wow. Well, okay. So I remember using the web in like late 93 using Lynx on a terminal mostly. I like there were a couple computer labs that had Mosaic installed, but there wasn't a lot to do on the web at that point. So kind of it was like a thing you would go to if somebody sent you a link and they were like, hey, you should check this out, and you'd load it up in Lynx and go there. But most of the time was spent on like Usenet and IRC and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What, how, I know at one point that Tim Berners-Lee maintained a list of all of the websites himself.
Just right there on the page.
He was the first Yahoo, basically.
Sure. I'm looking at his first webpage right now as we speak. It is still archived on CERN.
Yeah. Well, and then, but then at some point that became too onerous for him, right? Mm-hmm. Like he couldn't keep up with all the pages. And like there's, for me, there's a big gap from, hey, Tim Berners-Lee has all of the websites linked on his page, to like the rise of Yahoo and Lycos and WebCrawler and all of those kind of early search engines.
Yeah.
And I don't know where, like what were people, I don't even really understand what people were using the web for in like early 93 through like probably 95 is when it started to really take off.
Yeah. I mean, I would assume it was mostly academia, research, stuff like that.
That makes sense.
Early on.
Should we talk about 3D graphics?
Yes. I did not realize there were so many formative companies formed in that space in 1993.
So this is the moment when all of the stuff was kind of like research was happening. People were starting to split out from the original semiconductor companies and start their own things. And NVIDIA and Rendition kind of was popular because they were the first 3D accelerated Quake. Carmack made the first version of 3D accelerated Quake for like normal computers on a Rendition card later on. But NVIDIA was founded also in 1993 by three dudes who were like, we think massively parallel computing is going to be important one day.
Oh, and you don't say.
And we think that the 3D acceleration, their specific thesis was, we think that video games can be the flywheel that accelerates the development of these highly specialized processors. So, and when I say flywheel in this case, I mean like that they specifically thought, hey, the video game market will buy enough of these. If we make these 3D accelerators good, the video game market will buy enough of these that they will fund the research and development that will get us to massively parallel computing in the next 10 to 20 to 30 years. And it turns out they were right.
Yes. I mean, obviously they were very forward looking. I doubt any of this was an accident, but it does still kind of blow my mind looking at NVIDIA now and how many different areas of computing they are actually in that are not just games.
Well, I mean, that was the whole point.
Right. Like data centers and AI and like lots of other hardware accelerated stuff, right? Like that, like you just thought of them as a video game hardware company for so long that to see them have such a presence in non-video game markets these days. Again, I'm sure that they plan for it, but
it was an avowed public goal as early as like 2002 or 2003, right. as I recall.
Right. Do you know when 3D Effects was founded?
I think it was earlier.
Let me find.
Because I think they were making arcade cards by this point almost.
Oh, wow.
Later?
NVIDIA is older than 3D Effects.
Oh, interesting.
3D Effects wasn't founded until August 94.
Oh, well, there you go. So, at the time NVIDIA was founded, there were 24 other companies making public, like independent companies working on 3D accelerator and graphics technology.
Yeah. I know we've talked about it endlessly because we're old and we like looking back on that era, but if you weren't really around in that 90s explosion of, I mean, today it's NVIDIA, it's kind of AMD. I guess it's about to be Intel.
No, I think AMD counts. AMD and Intel are both part of much larger like processor manufacturers, right? And NVIDIA is the only one that remains independent.
I just mean in the graphics card space in particular. Like AMD's been putting out cards for a while, but I don't think they've been as competitive for the last few years on performance. They're not bad.
I think they're the high end isn't as competitive. The mid range, they're very competitive, is my understanding.
Right. I'm just thinking back to the Half-Life 2 era where like GeForce and Radeon were kind of trading the performance crown every year or two.
Remember? Well, yeah,
that's what I'm talking about is like you don't see the like shootout of the top end cards as much these days because NVIDIA just kind of dominates in the high end.
Well, I mean, that's a whole episode. But that happened because it became more about managing thermals and like what ridiculous things you were willing to do than about the math that's happening. Anyway.
I'm not saying it's like practically applicable to anything. It's more just bragging rights and stuff. But anyway.
Well, so that those 24 competitors ballooned up to 70 in the late 90s and then like consolidated down to three, basically now, two or three now, depending on how you count Power VR and where they landed and Intel. So, yeah. And the first real product wouldn't come out for a couple of years. In 95, they launched the NV1, which was an all-in-one card that was basically analogous to Sega Saturn kind of hardware. Sega ported a bunch of games to it, and it was literally a sound card, a video card, and like an IO card, because you could plug a joystick port into it. And it was an incredible commercial flop. So, yeah.
But they kept plugging.
Well, yeah, they rolled out the Revo 128 a couple of years later, and that like started the path. Like the Revo 128 was one of the first. Previously, the competitive 3D accelerators were standalone cards, and the Revo 128 was an all-in-one where it could do both 2D desktop Windows and 3D, and it kind of opened the door for games on Windows in a big way.
Yeah, so that history of GeForce video that Digital Foundry did a little while back has some stuff about the Revo 128, and it was the first card NVIDIA put out that was like kind of competitive. It wasn't like, it didn't set the world on fire, but it was definitely like a strong, like, okay, this is a company to watch. And then the TNT and then TNT 2 came along and things started to shift, and then the first GeForce kind of sealed it.
Well, and the interesting thing about the Riva is it had a bad launch because their initial drivers were rough, like Quake rendered with gaps in the window in between tiles and triangles and stuff like that. And as a result, it kind of highlighted to NVIDIA how important DevRel and driver building were. And they invested heavily in that. And that's continued for the last 30 years. Like they never stopped doing that. So
what else we got?
You want to talk about the Macintosh the Macintosh Color Classic, the first of the cheap Macintoshes?
Is that what that is? I don't know what a Mac Classic is. I'm going to type that in Google right now.
A Mac Classic is a small all-in-one computer with a 512 by 384 inch Sony Trinitron display that I think was 10 inches. I didn't write that down. Might have been 7. It was small. And it's the Mac. It's not the first Mac, the one that you think of as the one with the little floppy slot on the front, but it's the second. It's the updated version of that. It was a massively popular Macintosh. It ran System 7.1. It was one of the last of the Motorola 68030 Macs.
Okay.
And I think it shipped with like 4 megabytes of RAM, but you could go up to 128 megabytes with the appropriate extension cards.
Okay. Yes. I just found a picture of this thing. A Macintosh Color Classic, we should point out, is a different line than the Macintosh Classic.
Yeah, but it's the kind of spiritual successor to the Macintosh Classic.
Upgraded version of that. Yes. This is starting to look like middle school to me.
I was going to say, this is the computer your high school library probably had.
This is squarely, I remember using one of these at school. But also probably worth pointing out, this is like deep into the post-Jobs era, the post-Jobs, pre-Jobs return.
This is...
He left in 85, I just saw. So this is...
In 95.
No. He left in 85.
Oh, right.
He left Apple in 85. Yeah, yeah. And he came back in like what, 96, 97?
Yeah, 97.
So this is like deep. This is verging into that territory where they were flip-flopping CEOs constantly and on the verge of bankruptcy.
They weren't. Yeah, this is when they were spending the money that put them on the verge of bankruptcy a few years later.
Right.
It was $1,400, Brad.
Whew.
Yeah,
that's pricey. Let's see. I have it right here in front of me. That is over $2,600 That is over $2,600 in 2021 dollars.
Yeah, it was a cheap Mac and a very expensive computer.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine. Yes. It was a fine computer. Yeah. My favorite note that I learned about it today is that it had a little cutout on the front where it had the name of the computer was something that was put on in the factory so they could sell it in multiple regions without having to screen print it on multiple times because of the U in the Commonwealth countries.
Yeah. That just a little badge that just snaps right off.
It just snaps in and off.
Yeah. Remember case badges?
Oh yeah.
I miss case badges.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
I'm probably good.
I may have lamented this before. My parents got rid of our old family computer from the 90s not long ago, which really bummed me out.
Oh, wow. You should have called that one in.
I made a mistake when I said it was okay to get rid of that. Anyway, I was going through some boxes last time I was there, and I did find a bunch of parts from that era of computers. Like I found my first 3FX card. Ooh. And somehow the case badge from that very first family computer was stuck to the 3DFX card. So I still have the little vinyl. Is it vinyl? I guess I was thinking vinyl.
Was it a puffy one?
Yeah, it's like the puffy plastic, like kind of rounded, and it stuck on the front in the little case badge slot.
Yeah, it's funny. Fun. Those, because like you put Intel stickers on those usually, right? Intel or AMD stickers?
Yeah, well, at the time, the screwdriver shop, which I finally was able to find the name of again, People's Computers in Asheville.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course,
so,
People's.
Yes. Is So I've got the little case badge from. I also found, apparently at some point in college, I thought it would be funny to get a Dark Side of the Moon case badge.
Wow.
I found that in the box as well.
Anyway, I never engaged with case badge culture, I guess.
Case badges were cool. I think I also modded a blue LED into my case at the time. Remember when LEDs were like very new?
Yeah, they were expensive. They're phenomenally expensive.
Yeah. Like I think I spent, God, I don't know, like
probably $10.
They're like, yeah, it was several dollars at least for this one LED that I,
wow,
that I wired into my case so it would look cooler.
See, anyway. As soon as blue LEDs got cheap, I got a piece of electrical tape and stuck it over every blue LED in the house.
God, yeah. Remember that era when literally everything had a blue LED in it?
Because they were so bright,
too. They seemed exotic, and people couldn't stop using them, and oh.
Yeah, it was a dark time.
Yes. I mean, bright, but also, yes.
Yeah. But, yeah, fair.
All right. Formats?
Oh, everybody loves a good file format. What you got?
Standards? Codecs?
Look, all of these things, these are all hot words for me.
Should we burn? I've got a bunch here. Should we just burn through all of them?
Look, man, you're driving.
Okay, the MPEG-1 spec was published in 1993.
Oh, yeah, it's a compact disc video. Very popular in Europe and piracy scenes, not so much in the United States, as
yes,
I recall.
Yes, apparently it was designed to compress VHS quality video. Like, that was the objective, was obtain or achieve VHS quality video at 1.5 megabits per second.
Wow.
And then, I mean, I guess that was basically the first, that was like kind of the dawn of digital TV, right? Like, that was when they finally were able to compress encode video in a way that you could distribute over cable and satellite and stuff like that.
Well, so I feel like the cable boxes stayed analog for a long time, but maybe the DirecTV boxes of that era. I think the DirecTV boxes were all MPEG 2.
That's probably right. Cause like MPEG 2 is also what DVDs use, right? Like that was,
yeah,
I think that MPEG 2, a much wider, more widely adopted standard. But the point is, like, this is the beginning of standardization that would lead to all of that.
Well, yeah, it's the precursor format for like everything that's like H.264 and all. I mean, the math isn't the same, but like in terms of lossy digital video compression, this was the beginning of it. Yes. from a consumer perspective.
Speaking of lossy compression,
I love a good lossy compressor.
Mm-hmm. The MP3 format was also published in 1993. Oh,
Brad, tell me about psychoacoustics.
I don't have much to tell you other than I think they subtract the stuff that most people can't hear.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting research done about what you can and can't hear, and then they built a couple of Fraunhofer, right? Built some codecs on that.
Dude, I tried to make sense of the Fraunhofer involvement in MP3 and just gave up at some point.
Okay.
Like there were a bunch of different bodies originally involved in defining the spec, but then, like, you know, 10, 15 years of running into Fraunhofer copyright on everything that used MP3 and stuff. You know what I mean? I don't know how they came to solely control this format.
I wonder if it was that they were the last like stick in the mud. Everybody else signed co-licensing agreements and Fraunhofer was just like, no, pay me, man.
That might be it. I don't know. Like I said, it was too complicated to make a lot of sense of.
It's weird to me that we still, because okay. So one of the things is they're like, okay, if you part of the idea here is that these frequencies will drown out these other frequencies. So if you have these frequencies, you can just X out that data, which turned out to not be true in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. Like one of the reasons MP3 kind of the format, the quality kind of sucks is that you actually lose subharmonics and stuff that people can detect, even if they don't necessarily realize they're detecting them. But for some reason, we still like, I can go to Amazon right now and buy a bunch of MP3s.
Why are we still using MP3, dude? Next year, it will be 30 years old.
I mean, look, I can still take a file that I download from Amazon and play it on my Diamond Rio PMP 300. Maybe. I don't know. I probably can't. I think I need a parallel port to use that thing. So I probably can't actually use that.
Dude, AAC is like 20 years old now. Why are we?
Yeah.
Madness.
Yep.
Madness. I download a lot of game soundtracks from Steam.
Yeah. All MP3s.
It's changing. It varies.
Okay.
I actually wonder if Steam has maybe started standardizing this, because the last several I have gotten have all been the exact same contents, which is one folder of tagged MP3s and then another folder of untagged waves.
Oh, that's nice.
Like, they're all doing that now, which makes me wonder if maybe Valve has finally mandated that, because in the past it would be like, oh, this one might be MP3, this one might be FLAC, this one might be both. Like, it was very much up to the composer, I guess. But,
well, part of it is that the Steam Music Player only plays certain formats, I think, right?
Yeah, that might have something to do with it, but yeah. I appreciate the inclusion of Lossless. You might be surprised to hear.
Look, I ripped until I finally gave up and started subscribing to Spotify or RDO originally. I ripped CDs still for a long, long time.
Yeah, I have ripped all of mine. Anyway,
you want to talk about PCI cards?
Yes.
Brad, do you remember? You are too young to remember this. So my very first computer was a Wang with a VL bus card slot, which was a high speed like CPU interconnect slot. And then ISA slots. So the sound card slot in the old days, right?
As a matter of fact, what you just described also describes our very first family computer, because that's exactly what we had. Was a knockoff 486 with a VLB slot and a bunch of ISA. ISA
is what we always called them. I don't know what people actually. Yeah.
Or I think for a while I said ISA as if it was Visa without the V.
Look,
I was like 13, man. Come on.
So. Before that, though, they would have people would build special slots that would directly connect to your CPU. So like on Apple IIs and old Macintoshes and early PCs and stuff like that, you had this weird slot that only worked on the one PC, usually one brand of PC that would like slot in and give you a high speed connection directly to the CPU. PCI was basically designed to make that kind of high speed connection universal. So it would connect. They were parallel. They would connect directly to a shared bus that was usually integrated in the Northbridge at that point. The Northbridge being the thing closest to the CPU, that connected memory and CPU and I think storage, maybe. I think storage was maybe in the Southbridge back then. I can't remember. But it was a 32 and 64 bit spec, that ran at 33 megahertz for 66 megahertz for a maximum throughput of 533 megabytes per second.
Mm.
Which is kind of funny when you think about it now, because like your internet connection is faster than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other huge thing about it was it auto configured. So there was space dedicated to the PCI Express bus on the CPU registers in the memory, and the PCI Express controller knew enough. PCI controller knew enough to configure like DMA and memory address spaces and stuff like that for it without you having to flip dip switches and without you have it also enabled sharing like bandwidth sharing. So one device that was a bandwidth hog wouldn't saturate the bus. Like they basically did time slicing. So like one card would have this much time and then the next card in queue would get some time if there was another card in queue. But if the bandwidth hog needed, you know, if there was nothing else in the queue, then the bandwidth hog would just keep taking those slots until such a time as something else asked for time.
It was a huge deal.
It is impossible to overstate how important PCI was.
Yeah. Like in some sense, thinking back on that era, like there is very much like the time before PCI and the time after, right?
Well, yeah. Cause I mean, if you think about it, the thing that you got was the PCI was what empowered the early video cards,
right?
3D accelerators.
Right. I mean, the performance aspect is huge, but actually you talking about the auto configuration stuff makes me realize how equally huge that was, because having to manually configure all your expansion cards was a pain in the ass.
Well, not just that. It meant that like, it wasn't a thing that most normal people would do.
Right.
You had to like, literally the process was take out all the old ISA cards, look at what the jumpers were set to in terms of IRQs and memory addresses.
Yeah.
And then you would have to, you would have to know enough as a user to know, okay, this one gets this IRQ and this memory address, and then this one's going to be clear. And if you mess that up, then the result was that the computer would just crash immediately when you plugged it in and turned it on. It was bad.
And then, you know, later you started being able to configure those things through software, but still you had to know what those things were and what to set them to. And it was just a lot.
Yeah. Well, and often you would have to configure it in hardware and software.
Yeah.
So like, or you'd have a situation where like the card would be like, okay, this card can use IRQ 5 or 7, but not anything else. So like it was weird
looking at you, Sound Blaster.
Yeah. Thanks, Sound Blaster. So that, and then for me, that and the Pentium are kind of hooked together in my brain. Pentium was the P5 era, the i586 compatible, you know, Intel's successor to the 486, which was a monster.
Right. Also, seeing you listed both of these here on this list we made, and seeing that kind of mind blowing for me, because we didn't get our first family computer until after 1993, and it did not have a Pentium or PCI. And I was like, wait a minute, what were we doing? But I guess those things were probably like massively expensive at that time, right?
Well, so I bought a Pentium for my sophomore year in school, because I had inherited the old family Wang when I went to my freshman year. And then I was like, I need a faster computer. My daughter, my sister needed a computer for high school at that point. So they got the Wang back, and we went to Sam's and bought an AST Pizza Box Pentium 60. That was one of the first wave of Pentium 60s. The neat thing about it was it could do multiple instructions per clock. So it had like a main pipeline that could do everything, and that had a secondary pipeline that could do a subset of everything, basically. And they could do that simultaneously. It required a lot of compiler work, apparently, by Intel to like make applications take advantage of that, because it was kind of conceptually, at least in the x86 space, it was conceptually new. Like DEC had done Superscalar before.
Right.
But then later on, they added the MMX extension things, which were kind of marketing nonsense, but also helped video playback and stuff like that.
Yeah.
In that they could do the same instruction on multiple data. So you could do the math on decoding video with a faster pipeline, faster throughput on the pipeline, basically.
Right. Also, you've listed the FDIV bug here, which I had completely forgotten about.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. So the FDIV bug was this researcher was doing prime number division and found that the Pentium, early Pentiums, the Pentium 60 and 66 mostly, I think, they would do division wrong in very predictable ways. Mm-hmm. It didn't apply to virtually any normal computing load. Like if you were calculating large prime numbers and dividing large prime numbers, it would apply there, but that was kind of it. But nonetheless, because Intel had spent, like, the other thing that was noteworthy about the Pentium era is that they spent money marketing the brand,
yeah,
because they had gotten hosed on 486, because you can't trademark a number, it turns out.
Right. And then all the clones appeared. Which is what we had our first our first computer, the family computer I mentioned. It was, I think I've said this before, it was a Texas Instruments knockoff of a Cyrix chip, which itself was kind of a knockoff of the Intel 486.
Yeah. And well,
so,
and
like, there were clones, there were other types of CPUs called 486 out there everywhere. And yeah, like Pentium, they actually they branded it instead of just calling it a 586.
And their whole thing was all of the clones have devalued the 486 brand to the point that, like, they couldn't because people would buy a bad Cyrix knockoff of the 486 and be like, this thing isn't that fast at all. These things, computers suck, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I got to looking at it, like, apparently. So Texas Instruments apparently was manufacturing the Cyrix 486s. And then at some point they just started making their own, which is how we ended up with what we had. But it was a 486 DLC at 40 megahertz, which, from what I've read, was actually in the sort of like high end 386 territory of performance.
That reads from what I remember at the time.
It got the job done.
The FDIV thing was like a huge, because Intel had spent all this money marketing these Pentium processors, then the people who wrote about technology and business at the time in mainstream newspapers, like the FDIV bug was covered in the New York Times and the Boston Globe and like big newspapers.
It was like a huge boondoggle and for public relations, right?
Yeah, it was on the nightly news,
right.
And Intel was like, yo, man, you're not ever going to do the math that causes this problem, so it's probably fine. But then they ended up having to replace processors for anybody who wanted them.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, which, like, it took a long time for them to get there. But it actually, the two knock-on effects of this were later generations, like, I think 10 years later, when they released Nehalem, they were able to do microcode changes that would have been able to fix bugs like the FDIV bug. And also they started testing with theoretical math models before they would release processors, finalize processor designs to hopefully find these types of errors beforehand. And then the other thing that came on to was the way they handled like recalls. Cause they completely, like, they actually had a recall plan after this, cause this went so poorly. What do you want to do now?
Shift gears here a little bit.
Okay.
1993 was the year that Jurassic Park was released.
Oh, yes. The dinosaur movie. Eh?
Yes. I meant to watch it last night. I got about halfway through it and fell asleep, which is not a commentary on the movie. I think the movie still held up pretty well.
I find, having rewatched it fairly recently, the CG especially is still stunning.
Some of it, like that first reveal of the Brontosaurus, like the, you know, it's the classic scene, Sam Neill like takes his glasses off and ruffles his hair. He's so taken aback or whatever. But like, it was like kind of shocking how well, and a lot of the T-Rex scenes too, like some of that CG, like shockingly still effective for how old it is.
Well, so, yeah, the story on Jurassic Park is that Spielberg wanted to make Schindler's List, and Universal was like, yeah, you can do that, but you got to make a dinosaur movie. You got to make this dinosaur Wait, movie first.
Really?
Yeah.
This
is not a joke.
I have to look this up. That sounds insane to me. Like, look, he had to be goaded into making this.
No, he wanted to make it, but he wanted to do them in the other order.
Oh, okay.
So they wouldn't agree to the budget that he wanted for this until and the budget he wanted for Schindler's List until he signed up to do the dinosaur movie first. They got in a big bidding war for the script because Michael Crichton, before the book was even out, like the movie people were like, we got to make this movie. And so Spielberg was like, I want to make like a movie that's like a monster movie, like Jaws, same kind of vein. And he put together a team, Stan Winston, who did the puppets, like the life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex head and stuff like that. ILM did VFX, and he brought in Phil Tippett to do stop motion for the wide shots, for the big shots of dinosaurs and stuff in the background. Phil Tippett animated did stop motion work for Starship Troopers and a bazillion things. He did this hollow chess in Star Wars, I believe. He did the AT-ATs and he did the animation for the AT-ATs in Empire Strikes Back.
It's like a stop motion legend, basically.
He is a stop motion legend. Yeah.
But so are you saying there was originally going to be no CG in Jurassic Park? That it was all going to be stop motion because I feel like the movie would be remembered incredibly differently if it had not had the like incredibly impactful CG that it did.
So originally the plan was to do all stop motion and Tippett was going to do the stop for the wide shots, puppets for the close-ups. And that was it. Right. So they did the animatics and they did the first mock-ups for the wide shots of like the brontosauruses and the dinosaur herds and stuff like that. And they were like, oh, this isn't going to work. And one of the folks from ILM was like, hey, I think we can do the dinosaurs at computer animated. So they did the first animatics of the skeleton for the T-Rex and they were like, okay, this can probably work. Let's keep going on this, blah, 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 blah. They brought in a paleontologist to be the dinosaur consultant. So they didn't have, you know, which is where all like the modern, the 1993 modern paleontology of the, you know, dinosaurs being more avian than reptilian and stuff like that came from. And Phil Tippett and Spielberg were looking at the animatics come back at one point, the computer animatics come back and Spielberg said to Tippett, I think you're out of a job. And Tippett replied, don't you mean extinct? And they literally lifted that and put it in the movie.
Wow.
Like Spielberg liked that so much. They put it in the movie.
That's incredible.
So Tippett's credit on this is Dinosaur Wrangler.
Huh.
Okay. They brought in the folks that were going to do the stop motion to supervise the animation and make sure that it looked like, cause one of the things that stop motion animators are traditionally really good at is making things look like they behave like normal, like animals and like real creatures. So they did that. A lot of those stop motion animators learned to do computer animation as a result of this. And they worked with ILM. So ILM did the renders and Tippett's folks did a lot of the animation. And it was a real like they were rewarded massively in terms of commercial success. Cause it was the highest grossing movie until Titanic came out.
Was it really?
And then they released it. They re-released it at the 20-year anniversary. It became the oldest movie to have $1 billion gross at the box office. Jeez. After that 2013 re-release.
I knew it was big. I knew it was like biggest film of the year easily. I didn't realize it was the biggest film of all time until Titanic. That's
for a long time. Wow.
I think of it as kind of the dawn of the CG effects driven blockbuster. Making determinations like that is incredibly arbitrary to the point that it's kind of useless. I mean, like, I
also true
because I also think of like I think of Terminator 2 as the first like really resounding use of CG. But then like even as I say that, I think like, well, The Abyss had stuff that was also super impressive. But like, I don't know. Like T2 in my mind is the one that made a ton of news for its use of CG.
And then
Jurassic Park came along and was like the entire movie was sort of, I started to say propped up by it, which is not what I mean. But you know what I mean? Like I said, Jurassic Park would be a very different movie without the CG.
Well, I was going to say the thing about Jurassic Park is the CG was good enough that you didn't really think of it as being CG. Like when you watched The Abyss and you saw the tentacle, or you watched Terminator 2 and you saw the metal man, like those things were like, oh, that's a cool. I've never seen anything like that before. But then the tagline is you'll believe dinosaurs are real. And like it played. Like I saw Jurassic Park the weekend it opened at the Uptown in DC, which is like a big Cinerama theater, you know, 80-foot screen or whatever. And people gasped. Like the reaction wasn't like cheering and woos and all that. It was like these dinosaurs look real. Like right. the T-Rex chase scene in the car, the Brontosaurus reveal, like all of that is so good. And they blended, like Stan Winston's puppets are incredible. The puppets that he made for the Velociraptors are awesome. Like the whole thing is, it's Spielberg doing some of his very best work. Like that period with that and Schindler's List. And I mean, even Hook,
Hook is, oh boy.
Hook has problems, but I love Hook anyway.
Yeah. Watching it last night reminded me of that particular Spielbergian mode that is very like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like it's very theatrical. Like there's a certain kind of movie he makes that absolutely knows it's a movie. You know what I mean? It's got this like heightened, like staged kind of thing.
Well, I mean, so when you look at like how the book changed, cause Crichton wrote the first draft of the script and then they handed it off and Spielberg did his thing to make it more human. And like the changes that they made in that process resulted in like these really lovely character arcs that are also super easy to follow. And like, it was kind of an early four quadrant film. Cause like a kid can watch that and be like, oh man, I see these kids and they represent me. And a dad can watch it. And it's like, you see Sam Neill and Laura Dern, you're like, oh wow, they're kind of parents, but also really shit out at the beginning. And then they get good at the end. And like, there's a series of really great. And Ian Malcolm is there for the 20 something, like this 20 something. I'm too cool for sure. This kid business.
Yeah.
Like it is such an intentional, like it is a designed product in the most, in a lovely, lovely way. I don't want that to take away from it.
That's kind of what I mean. There's a theatricality to everything. Like there, it's not going for any kind of verisimilitude, which like is the opposite of Schindler's List, right? Where like that is trying to depict like real events. And this is very much like, you know, it's not like it looks like it's happening on a soundstage, but this is a hard thing to articulate. Like it has a larger than life, not real, like kind of stage quality to it that I kind of enjoy because it's kind of silly.
Well, but at the same time, it's like it's self-aware enough to not do the thing where it's like, holy shit, look at these dinosaurs. Like the way they convey that is with Sam Neill taking his hat off and pulling his glasses down so he can see with like unfiltered through his own eyes. Right.
Yeah.
And also I mean, I guess we had some green screen acting up until that point, but before that point, but like this was early in the green screen days. And the fact that they cast people who could do that. Who could do that work? Like Jeff Goldblum and Sam Neill and Laura Dern did a spectacular job with that whole thing. Like there's a couple of really good documentaries about it. God, what's the VFX magazine? I can't believe I'm not remembering. I read their Jurassic Park article about this last night. It was super good. Anyway,
I had that thought during the Brontosaurus reveal when they both stand up in the Jeep, like their eye lines are like perfect. Like they're both looking at exactly the same place that looks like they should be looking. Right. But like, that was probably like pre like all these standards and processes that have been developed, right. Of like kind of putting the tennis ball up on the post or whatever.
Well, like, I mean, they developed it. Like this is when all those things were starting to be figured out. Right. Like the difference between this and a bad version of this movie is that people aren't looking at the same thing. They're not reacting to the same thing. You know, there's a million ways to mess this up and one way to make it right. And right. They did a wonderful job.
Like, it's just amazing that they threaded the needle so well for how early and kind of primordial this is. Yeah. I got through the Brontosaur, the T-Rex Jeep attack, like all that stuff last night. And like, I had that exact same thought that you mentioned earlier, like even now, like literally last night coming out of some of those big showpiece scenes, like after the fact, it hit me like I didn't even think about the CG while I was watching that. Like I didn't even like I didn't pick that apart in my mind going like, oh, I can see where the lighting could be a little better there or whatever. Like even now, like watching it, you just absorb it as dramatic events on the screen and you don't really like the effects don't stand out even now.
I will also say if you have an opportunity to see it on a big screen ever, it's worth going. It presents much better. Like it looks fine on a TV, on a big TV. It's great, right? Whatever. And it's a fantastic film.
Yeah.
If you have the opportunity to watch it on the big screen, definitely go. Cause the impact is much, much greater. And like the beautiful thing is, yeah, you don't know what's a puppet and what's CG and it's a lovely film.
Yeah.
September 1993.
Whoa. Sounds ominous.
No, I mean, I went to college. Look, every September prior to 1993, there was this thing that happened where the new college kids would come in, they'd get access to the internet, they'd hop on Usenet, and then they would overwrite all social norms. And the old Usenet, because look, in 2022, where Usenet is the purview of pornographers and pirates and like not much conversation happens there anymore, I assume. In 1993, Usenet was basically the message board for the entirety of the internet. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you, there were social norms and requirements and rules about the way you posted. Like yes. you kept your topic, your posts were on topic. They were as brief as you could make them. You didn't ask questions that had already been answered. Things like, you know, like all of the grumpy old man internet stuff continued there.
Yes. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm guessing that Usenet was the incubator in which the concept of flaming came about.
Probably. Yeah. I feel like that's where a good flame started, but
Flame Wars.
Yeah. Well, you'd also have like, so Usenet was divided into subgroups. It was, you would have top level groups that were like comp or Psy or alt or whatever. And those were the kind of general buckets into which topics went. And like, most of them were pretty on topic. The alt dot was usually the kind of like, hey, here's where everything else goes. And the different groups would get pissed off at each other. Like this was the point at which like we had alt dot TV dot sci-fi dot Wesley Crusher die.
Yes.
Or alt dot binaries dot Barney dot GIF or, yes. You know,
alt dot TV dot Simpsons, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Those different groups would get pissed off at each other fairly regularly. And there'd be like cross pollination across like these subcultures where people would get upset with each other and send nasty messages and flood their channels.
I have a great historical example of what you're talking about here.
Ooh.
Called the Meow Wars.
Oh, I don't remember this one.
I've never heard of it before until I just went and Googled the term flame wars. Flaming was just like being an asshole to somebody. If it's not clear. Like,
but sometimes it was like channel on channel violence. Yes. Like people would, yeah.
That's apparently what the Meow Wars were. It was the wars began when some Harvard students who had colonized an abandoned news group for fans of Carl Malden, which was alt.fan.carl-malden.nose.
Who doesn't love Carl Malden? Really?
Let's see. And we're using it as a community news group for such posts about daily student life. Jokingly, those students just jokingly suggested harassing members of the Beavis and Butthead fan group, alt.tv.beavisandbutthead.
That was probably a wildly popular fan group back then, if I had to guess.
Yes. So apparently the Meowers were denizens of, I'm quoting from Wikipedia here, those were the members of the Beavis and Butthead news group, who responded to the invasion by adopting a scorched earth policy of rendering the Carl Malden news group unusable.
So... I guess punching up didn't work back then, huh?
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, even like, God, even the idea of like flaming somebody on the internet sounds so quaint and outdated at this point that like that was kind of the jargon of the time.
The funny thing about their Eternal September complaining generally was that it wasn't about like flame wars and stuff like that. It was mainly like, hey, use punctuation and like, you know, don't do signature files on your keep your SIGs under X number of bits, you know, stuff like that. So every September, the new kids would come to college and they'd jack up the Usenet for a few weeks or a month. But in 1993, it never stopped. because access to the internet started growing. CompuServe and AOL later in the fall and spring, respectively, I believe, added Usenet access to their online services. And from then on, basically, the internet has been a free for all. So we're still in eternal September, as near as I can tell.
It never ended. That's what eternal means, it turns out.
That it does. Brad, we're at a break point here.
We are.
We have been talking for an hour about this apparently more formative year than I realized.
Yeah, we made 3.5 pages of notes for this episode, and we've only gotten through page one so far. So we're maybe going to make this a two-parter.
I think we should make this a two-parter. We should come back next week and do 1993 part two.
Yeah, we've got all kinds. God, there's like, I did a whole space section here.
We even talked about the Newton.
The Newton.
We got to talk about Lua.
Lua and RAR files and UTF-8. And
what do you know about Biosphere 2? That's my question.
I mean, I can tell you nothing because you told me not to read about it, because apparently the truth is so mind-blowing that I have to discover it on the show.
Like many things, it was unexpected and unknown what actually happened. So we'll come back and finish 1993 part two next week, I guess.
Yes. Gosh. Macintosh clones, Silicon Graphics, Fermat's last theorem, all kinds of stuff still to talk about in 93.
Did you know that Fermat's last theorem was actually a conjecture until 1993?
The nerve of that guy.
I know. The original troll, actually. But now we've reached the point in time where we need to thank our listeners, because this is a 100% listener supported show. Yeah. Thank you all for supporting the show and letting us do this every week. We really enjoy it, and we love having you all around and helping us out. If you would like to become a patron of the show and help support the show yourself, you can go to patreon.com/techpod. Again, that's patreon.com/techpod, and sign up for as little as $2 a month. That's look. What would we have? What in 1993? Like, now we would say it's less than the price of a cup of coffee, but I think a cup of coffee is like $6 if you go to Starbucks now. So, sure. So what's the equivalent in 1993? Like, when I used to go downstairs in my when I worked for the congressman in Capitol Hill, I would buy a donut and a cup of coffee for like $2, $1.50, I think.
Okay.
I don't know what the under $2 in 1993 was.
Under $2. Let's see.
I mean, you could go to McDonald's for $4 back
then. Trying to think, like a gallon of gas or a pack of gum.
Oh no, a gallon of gas was $1.25 at most back then.
Yeah, if that. Less than $1.
A big gulp would have been like 50 cents probably.
Yeah, sure. About four big gulps. How about that?
Yeah. For less than the price of four big gulps, you can support Brad and me and can encourage us to continue making this fine product. And the URL again for that is patreon.com/techpod. As always, we would like to thank our executive producer tier patrons, including Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, Andrew Slosky, Bunny Thorpe Stovetop Crimes. Oh no, it's coming here too. Just Wedge.
What is going on?
Jacob Chappell, Joel Krauska, The Sound of Twinkies, David Allen, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much. We really appreciate your support.
Yes, we do.
And if you would, you can, again, go to patreon.com/techpod to find out more. Brad, don't crush ice on your glass stovetop. That's the thing I learned this week.
Don't crush ice on your glass stovetop.
Yeah.
Those sound like words to live by.
I'm
going to assume those were arrived at completely in a vacuum with no prior experience informing that mandate.
No context whatsoever needed for the 8 people who will understand what I'm talking about. That'll do it for us this week. Apologies for making this a surprise two-parter.
Yes, that was absolutely not part of the plan, but there's... Oh!
Yeah?
I didn't even mention... Okay, before we send it off...
Yeah.
Did you know that Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega was the very first MP3 ever created?
Really?
That's... Yes.
Because they use Suzanne Vega because her voice is so rich and mellifluous.
Maybe. I don't know. Or maybe the engineer, this was in the development of the format, apparently. Maybe the engineer in question was just a big Suzanne Vega fan.
Do you think he got tired of listening to the song?
Apparently they have referred to Suzanne Vega as the mother of the MP3 for that very reason.
Wow. The more you know. This is a surprise last plug fact.
There you go.
Thank you all for listening so much. We will be back next week with more 1993. Bye, everybody.